Hello, my name is Mike Diedrich, and this is the Veterans for Peace radio show broadcast on KODX 96.9 FM. The show is archived there and also on VFP92.org. And with me today are Will Alexson of Veterans for Peace 92 and Dan Gilman. I'll let Dan and Will introduce themselves briefly. Go ahead, Will.
All right, Will Alexson. I was in the U.S. Army from 1969 to 1970. It included a tour of Vietnam at that time. And I first joined Veterans for Peace in about 2004 after seeing a display of the Arlington Northwest tombstones and crosses and Bellevue. And it was a depiction of the number of deaths that were occurring in Iraq at that time. It ended up being over 4,000 monuments and crosses that were displayed around Seattle. And I started hooking up with some of the peace activists and the Veterans for Peace at that. And they invited me to join them. And 20 some years or so later, here I am after a couple of decades of working with Veterans for Peace.
Okay, thanks, Will. Dan.
Yeah, Dan Gilman. I was in Vietnam in 1969 as a medic. I was a draftee into the Army, served from 67 through 69. After the war and coming home, I began to listen to the hue and cry of the anti-war folks that were still protesting the war in Vietnam when I came home. And I started reading and looking into it and really came to the conclusion that it was an unnecessary and illegal war, not to mention being unjustified. And so I found Veterans Against the War and got their newspaper. And when the National Convention of Veterans for Peace came to Seattle is when I started my activism with Veterans for Peace and really working against war and for peace.
Okay, thanks, Dan. I probably introduced myself. I haven't done that in a while, but I was a Vietnam veteran and draftee originally. Ended up in Vietnam and military intelligence. I was an interrogator. Impetus to join Veterans for Peace was what I saw and did in Vietnam, and it was the way we fought the war, including a lot of, personally witnessed a lot of civilian casualties for high explosives, the way we went into villages and that sort of thing. And I came back to the States very disillusioned and angry, and got involved in originally with Vietnam Veterans Against the War, regional coordinator in Seattle. And then stayed an activist, but I mean, Vietnam Veterans Against the War sort of faded in activism after the American soldiers came home. But then I was with a group of people who founded the local chapter of Vietnam, Veterans for Peace 92, and this is our 20th year. And it's actually heartening to see some of the people that actually started that organization are still around and still active. We're getting a little grayer and older, but still going strong. And thanks to all those veterans. So, Will, you're going to actually introduce the program with a short summary of what we're talking about tonight.
Yes, sir. We're talking about the Climate Crisis and Militarism Project. That started, I've got a note here from one of the founders of the issue, and it says that at August At the August 2020 Veterans for Peace National Convention, a workshop was held on the climate and militarism. From this meeting, a group of 36 people showed up at an initial meeting to form the Climate Crisis and Militarism Working Group, led by Steve Morse and Vince Dejanich. Shortly after the first year in 2021, a steering committee formed and matured the working group into a fully integrated Veterans for Peace national project. We now have a PowerPoint presentations via Zoom that started in May 2021. The group has eight qualified lecturers and has given over 140 presentations to climate, environmental, peace, social justice, and political groups. And we've done numerous in-person talks, many radio interviews, and addressed college classes. And our mission statement is that Veterans for Peace Climate Crisis and Militarism Project is part of the worldwide movement to end the climate crisis and promote climate, environmental, racial, and economic justice. Our emphasis focuses on how U.S. militarism, the single largest institutional source of greenhouse gases on the planet, fuels the climate crisis.
That is the official name of that is the Climate Crisis and Militarism Project of Veterans for Peace. You can contact them at climate@veteransforpeace.org. That's their handle. And the other thing is, go ahead, Dan.
Well, I think it was natural that this national project got going, giving the crisis of the climate and the earth. And there's really very little awareness in the general population of how militarism and war contribute to the climate crisis. And I think it's one of the reasons we got started with this and challenging our citizens to look at our country's militarism and how that affects the environment and the earth and what needs to be done about that.
Well, in following that up, I mean, Veterans for Peace, of course, is not the only organization locally or nationally that's involved in these campaigns to combat military climate change, not to unmake, but also to deal with the crisis of military pollution worldwide. Will, could you talk to us a little bit about those other organizations that are involved in this effort?
I can. So in January and February this year, Veterans for Peace 92 decided to make a action team out of the Climate Crisis and Militarism Project. And I got the fortunate duty of being the go-to leader on the action team. And we started doing some things early on, January, February, March. And one of the earlier things we did was around Earth Day, where a couple of us went to Seattle Center and promoted our flyers that we had at the time, tried to reach out to people. There wasn't a lot happening there, but we did something. And a month or two later, we showed up at Boeing Field with the Extinction Rebellion group, as well as several other groups. And we started to spread the message that we were trying to build a coalition. And that coalition grew and has been functioning now most of the year. There's about 15 groups. We're meeting twice a month. And one of the first events was at Seafair. Dan, you want to talk about? Oh, Dan, you want to talk about the Fleet Week? You were involved in Fleet Week. That was one of our first events we had in the summer.
Yeah, Fleet Week is a week-long maritime project of Seafair. They bring in ships, mostly military ships, to be there in Elliott Bay. They have a parade of ships and they come in, and the fire boats out there with this spraying of the water and welcoming them, the ships in. And there's a fairly large contingent of people on the land and on the piers there that watch the parade of ships. And Ground Zero for years has been protesting that Fleet Week, which they call Peace Week. And they get in their kayaks or their small little boats and parade in front of the piers as the Navy ships go by. And they're really dwarfed by these huge battleships. 1 year, even the Golden Rule was here in Seattle, and that's the anti-nuclear sailboat. That's a project of Veterans for Peace as well. And it was here displaying the peace sign on its sail, and got some press for that. But we joined probably a decade ago in protesting with our flags, with flyers, and now we're a regular that sees these military ships really just as recruitment tools for the Navy. You know, in providing entertainment really for the local folks here. Really, if you look at it, you know, Seafair is really designed to be a family friendly and to represent Seattle. But Seattle, you know, is really known as a environmental city. They often call it the Green City. And this kind of goes contrary to the values of city. You know, we're really big on recycling, on solar panels, on pathways for bikes and hiking, just all sorts of things, you know, encouraging us to buy electric cars and be mindful of our carbon footprint. But these big ships are just huge polluters of the air with their greenhouse gases when they come into the city, and it just seems like it's contrary to the beliefs and values of really what Seattle's about. And we're going to try to highlight that in this project as we take on Seafair.
You know, I might add that it's sort of a schizophrenic relationship that this city and this area has with not just the Navy, but the military. Boeing, as you know, or many people would know, is a huge producer of military equipment and armaments. They produce Tomahawk missiles, among other things.
Yeah.
And the other part of SEAF, one of the other big parts of SEAF, are very popular too, is the Blue Angels. And something that personally, well, I try and leave the area because it just grates my teeth. I know it puts my dog under the table. And I try and tell people that, have you ever seen what these combat aircraft do to people? You know, see what they leave for, you know, dropping 500 or 250 pound bombs or missiles. And I've had people who are liberal otherwise say, well, they're so, you know, they're so pretty, you know, and interesting. I wrecked a couple of dinner parties with this sort of discussion, but they are combat aircraft. They're designed to blow up stuff and blow people up. The other thing is, of course, that they're hideous polluters. The Sea of Air Climate Action Campaign notes that each Navy Blue Angel or Air Force Thunderbird burns 1,200 gallons of expensive jet fuel per hour, 54,000 total gallons for a weekend show. And these are not aircraft that are concerned about. Well, they're dirty jets. You know, it's not like even a commercial aircraft. So they're dumping a lot of pollution here, and also the sound pollution is just horrendous. The other thing about, while I'm talking about this aircraft, you mentioned the Seattle's got a big air museum, and if you go down to that, we've actually had some protests down there. You go down and look at the aircraft there; they're almost all military aircraft. And people that I know who are pilots are saying, "Well, it's a museum of planes. It's mostly a museum of military planes that are, as I said, designed to blow stuff up." I think that our continuing activism and trying to bring that to the public's attention is certainly appropriate. What else could you add to that, Dan, or Will or Dan?
Will, you want to finish on the seafarer action?
I'll back up to, so there we were going from a couple of members of our coalition in June, and we threw together a quick Zoom meeting, and about half a dozen of those groups showed up, and we had a start of a coalition. Some of the early groups were Extinction Rebellion, Earth Care Not Warfare, 350.org, Rise Up, Ground Zero, Veterans for Peace 134, and Resist U.S. War, to name a few. And these people were jumping on the bandwagon quick, very interested in doing something. And out of that conversation, of course, came the idea to do Summit Seafair, which had been the goal. That's what they did down in San Diego, where it started, was they approached the big air show down there. It's a three-day event, and the chapter and Veterans for Peace chapter down there in San Diego put together a coalition of like-minded people and started to protest down there. And so we were going to mirror that. And those people that jumped on board with us were anxious to go. And so we ended up scheming and planning to put together an event at Seafair. And we showed up with banners and flags and signs. We must have had, I'm guessing, 20, 25 people from those groups that day. We did both days at the Seafair Gate at Genesee Park, where we had, there was two entrances to that part of the park. There's several entrances, but we chose the Genesee Park entrance. And we passed out flyers. And also we did a walk through the Seafair event, which was free on Friday, to kind of scope it out and see what it was doing. And there we saw that you walk through the gate, and the first thing you saw was military apparatus and signs, and there was probably 10 or 15 booths manned by the military right out of the chute. It kind of gave us a taste of what that seafarer's transition to versus a family-friendly event. So we were loaded up after that to make waves, and Saturday and Sunday we did start doing the protest, and the TV station showed up, and various members of the community showed up, and I think the coalition grew some more after that to the point where we're at today. Dan, do you want to add anything more to that?
I mean, we had a huge banner that you could see for a long way saying military air shows, fuel, climate crisis. And that message could not be not seen by anybody walking, you know, within a quarter of a mile, I think, of our banner. So a lot of people saw it. A lot of people simply ignored it. A few people said nasty remarks, and then even less people commended us for being out there and doing what we were doing. But just to say that it's not just the Blue Angels, it's they have a whole air show. When the Blue Angels fly, it's at the end of the day around 4 o'clock, but they start the air show around, I think it's 11 o'clock. So they have aircraft, military aircraft after military aircraft, flying, and again using great amount of fossil fuels, and they do this, twice during that Seafair weekend. So, and the other thing is, not only is Boeing the main sponsor of the air show, but they're also the main sponsor of Seafair. So it's really going to be a challenge in this area, who, most with so much employment at Boeing, being the perceived as a great corporation and doing great things. But most people don't know that 60% of Boeing's work is military. And so, it's also something that we want to make the public aware of, that this is not just a commercial aircraft corporation, but it supplies the military with many, many weapons of war.
Can you add anything to that, Will?
Yes, I can. I can add that I was really happy to see some of the coalition members dive into the whole idea around the amount of pollution and the mess that we've created on this planet. And there's it's a lot of environmental groups that have become part of the coalition. There's some groups that are definitely anti-war. The U.S. Resist U.S. War, of course, is pretty active in campaigning against Boeing. The Seafair event has rents Genesee Park, and nobody can go inside the park to just hang out or wander around without having some credentials. You can walk through the entrance to the park. But last August, we tried to set up inside the park to do our demonstration, and we were asked politely to move out onto the sidewalk, which at the end of the day, we probably did a better job out on the sidewalk than we would have if we'd been actually in the park. But that remains to be seen. There was I mentioned I think I mentioned that there were some locals that stopped by, and we found out later on that some of the local neighborhoods, like you said, Mike, have many members that leave town during the event, so they're sympathetic to our cause. And we're finding out that some of those people have have knowledge of people that can be contacted. They've been leaving town for so long and being upset that I think they're trying to find a channel to vent, and that's a big asset for us to have people that are going to be excited about doing this and resourceful as well.
The we the Veterans for Peace and other organizations have gone several times to more than once to support Ground Zero. Ground Zero has been a longtime protester at the gates of Bangor and on Kitsap Peninsula about the Navy presence there. And the other thing that is in Bangor is of course the Navy sub base, and like many other bases, the ground pollution is something that's not really remarked upon that much, except that I noticed that there was an article in the Seattle Times recently on the ground pollution of drinking water wells at the military bases in Washington State. And it was a Seattle Times article, hundreds of drinking water wells near military bases or other facilities in Washington have been contaminated by per and polyfluoroalkali substances, or PFAS. The test results of 2 years published by the military, actually. So far, the military has confirmed the release of these forever chemicals, renamed for their pervasiveness in the environment. 10 military installations in the state, many of them near the Sellers Steep. The PFAS were detected by the Department of Defense testing in 866 private drinking water wells. Nearly half of all wells tested by the military in the past 2 years in the state. So that's a persistent and long-term sort of problem it's going to be. Of course, the other thing is talking about long-term military pollution is the mess in Hanford, and then we're going back to the World War II production of nuclear weapons, and those storage tanks from nuclear contaminated waste actually are leaking. Some of them are leaking, and that is potential contamination of the Columbia River. My experience, some of the my experience was actually, I used to be a commercial painter and working in shipyards, and the one of the things they used to do at Todd and Lockheed, which is right on the Duwamish there, they would sandblast military vessels, which had zinc chromate and lead paint, of course, on them, lower the dry dock into the water, and then push all the contaminated sandblasts and paint into the Duwamish River. Now, they can't do that anymore because people know about it. Now the taxpayer is going to have to pay for that pollution, toxic mitigation. You can't get it out of there. The only way to get rid of that stuff is just to dump more sand on top of it. So it's hard to say what sort of how bad the pollutions actually are on military bases with contaminants. Spilled fuel and that sort of thing. And of course, the other thing too is on a place like Fort Lewis, they have been using Lewis as an artillery range for decades. They also use it as a small arms range, and they've got these berms built up there which are full of lead, which is a contaminant and leaking into the groundwater. So the military doesn't really allow civilian testing on its bases. But it's hard to say that this stuff is not going to be a long-term problem. I want to talk about some of the U.S. negative contribution to the climate crisis and greenhouse gases.
I'd like to back up just a second,
sure.
Mike, and go back to that the current focus of our coalition. Kind of wrap that up a little bit.
Sure, go ahead.
If I could, if we have time, I'm assuming.
Oh, we got time.
So we have four subgroups now under the coalition. We have outreach, research, our petition group, and the social media group. Dan and I have been involved a little bit in the outreach, and what that's about is contact, making a list of people and groups that we can contact. We've worked on putting a letter together and a spreadsheet together of those groups so that we can contact them and ask them to join us either at the monthly meetings or at the demonstrations that may occur down the road. And that seems to be working pretty well. We've started the campaign on that in the last month or two to broaden the coalition a little bit. Dan, you want to talk briefly about the research part?
Yeah, the research committee is really important to our efforts there in finding out who's in control of CFAIR? Who makes the decisions? Who's the deciders? We know it's somewhat under the umbrella of the city of Seattle, but it seems to be independent to a large degree. Anyway, they are researching the Seafair Committee and trying to find out who's on the board. And where, once we get that information, we will be contacting the board and trying to set up meetings with them. And so that's really key to our strategy and trying to get rid of the Blue Angels in the next 3 years. But also they're working on researching the science, the pollution that these different airplanes, these different Navy ships emit. We know that, you know, the military is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases as an institution. And so they're doing some work there, and they're talking with a department at the University of Washington to get assistance in doing some of the research that needs to be done on this regard. So they have a lot of work to do, and if anybody's you know, that orientated, likes to investigate things, we'd appreciate your contacting us and helping us out there. Will, would you have the contact information if people want to contact us? How would they do that?
Yes, I do. It's buried in my notes somewhere, but okay. I can probably get it to Mike after the meeting, if that'd be all right, Dan, Mike.
Yeah, sure. Okay. While we're on this topic, how much of this information is available or cited on our VFP92.org website on climate control and the military and military pollution?
Well, good that you would ask, because last night we talked about that as part of the media group. We've got a couple of VFPers working on that, including our own Jim Now, and they're working with Facebook and a couple of the other media groups, social media. We've got Facebook and Instagram. And along with that, they're going to start working with our local people at 92 to get more information on our website. And like Dan said, we do have a website building for the Seafair Coalition as well, that Jim and Steve are doing a good job there. It's an ongoing thing to use various support options like Google Documents. And I'm not the tech guy, so I can't tell you all about that, but the social media group is working hard to be able to get more information out to the general public.
Well, that kind of information is critical, especially for sitting on a dock or a pier or something like, and the boats are out there floating around with their nuclear reactors and the planes are flying overhead, that we can actually not only protest this, but give accurate, you know, verifiable information about how bad this pollution is and how much money we're spending on our military in this country, which is like our military is something like the next 10 countries in the world don't spend as much as we're spending. There's information gathering. VFP, I mean, I and many other people consider the VFP to be an educational institution, and this certainly fits into that effort, research and promotion of facts. So it's not just saying this is a bad thing, but this is why it's a bad thing. You know, it's critical to our reputation and to our what we call it, people respect us for what we say and do and why, you know. So, Dan, is it time for you to talk about this last part, or are you through talking, Will?
Well, the last thing that came up last night at one of our monthly meetings was the petition work, which is a relatively new group that we're starting. And that petition group, the idea there is to work with outreach and research in order to come up with the names of individuals and groups, and then start figuring out how we can actually come up with a petition at various events or somehow, including with the social media and putting all those efforts together and create a petition that may carry some weight down the road with the various cities and county people and Boeing and whomever else. So that's going to be an important part of our work as time goes by. The timeline for that to prepare and launch and amplify is now March. So we're going to have a couple of months to put that together and start working on getting the Seafair board to start thinking about what it's doing. Dan, do you have anything you want to add to that petition work?
Well, just in the research area, I didn't mention yet, is that the committee is making freedom of information requests. And we do have an attorney on the committee, and she's very valuable in helping us make these freedom of information requests on different aspects of what we need to know. And as the weeks and months go by, we should be able to have a lot more information that will help us figure this whole puzzle out. But that's been an important piece as well for the research group.
And Mike, to your point on the educational, I think maybe Veterans for Peace 92 ought to consider having the CCMP, maybe Gary Butterfield from down in San Diego, come up and talk one more time about it as we've moved along here and incorporated into the chapter's work a little bit more. I think that'd be a good idea if we could work that in the coming year.
Yeah, but you know, I think that we're sort of we're in the heart of the dragon here in the Puget Sound area, in particular Washington State, with Bremerton, Bangor, and Lewis McChord. We've got a lot of military and then, of course, Boeing. There is Dan is right. You know, this state and this, or this, certainly Western Washington, the Seattle area, has a lot of positive things going about recycling and energy and alternative uses and alternative energy sources and that sort of thing. But as I mentioned earlier, it's a schizophrenic sort of relationship that this area has with its military and its sort of adoration, really, of things military. I should mention that one of these things that VFP has done for, I think it's 15 years now, is that we participate in Armistice Day celebrations in Auburn, and also, which is billed itself as the largest veterans parade west of the Mississippi, and also in recent years at Armistice Bell ringing thing at St. James Cathedral. And these sort of public displays by Veterans for Peace, particularly in Auburn, where when we first started there was some opposition to, vocal opposition to our presence there. We are the only anti-war group in the parade, and there's, well, a couple of hundred entries, something like that. And these days, with the failure of what we've been doing in Iraq and Afghanistan in particular, we get a lot more sympathy and applause, actually. You know, and we stuck it out, and what we were doing was sort of a simple sort of presence of Veterans for Peace in opposition to the war. We're an anti-war organization. Some people don't want to see that sort of thing, but it's really critical for VFP and as veterans to put this out there, is that we're not a bunch of crazy pro-war drug-addled veterans, combat veterans, but somebody, organization is thoughtful and presenting ourselves as an alternative to the current military, you know, glad hand narrative of the Puget Sound. So that was sort of a digression, but that's what we do at Seafair too, you know. And we've all been down in places like that, and they say, well, how could you object to something like the Navy or the Air Force, and their pieces their mission, pieces prosperity, you know, this is the sound of peace, but it's not. Dan, are you going to wrap this up with a...
I'll give some examples of at nationally and more locally examples of military pollution and environmental damage. But first, I wanted to say, you know, we know that the military is a huge polluter, and that the biggest institutional polluter on the planet. But it's been organizations like Veterans for Peace and some of these environmental groups that have dug up the information. The problem is that we don't know more, and maybe how bad it is because the military doesn't have to report its environmental impact. In 1997, at the Kyoto Protocol, the U.S. pressured the organization to exempt it from reporting its carbon footprint and any environmental impact that they have. So that's why there hasn't been more information sooner on the damage and impact of the military, but there is quite a bit of information now because of these groups that are getting involved to expose that. Well, you know, one indication of the greenhouse gases that the military produces is just looking at the amount of gas engines that are at play here. You've got the military has 3,476 airplanes, 831 tanks, 200 ships, 760 helicopters, and tens of thousands of jeeps, ambulances, trucks, utility vehicles, all around the world. That in many of the 800 bases that are U.S. bases around the world, and then of course around 700 bases here in the United States. So that's a huge indicator, just about the amount of gas guzzling vehicles that they have that are in operation around the world. Well, and just thinking about the war that the three of us were in, people know probably about Agent Orange and the damage it caused to the environment in Vietnam with the spraying of defoliants called Agent Orange that defoliated trees that got rid of, you know, killed the vegetation leaked into the waterways and lakes and streams, and often spraying rice fields, rice paddies, intentionally or not. But that was a huge environmental discretion. Of course, the other one are unexploded ordnance that still are in Vietnam. We dumped 8 million tons of ordnances on Vietnam, and so 10 to 15% of them didn't even explode. And so there are efforts since the normalization of relations with Vietnam to clear and get rid of those unexploded ordnances. And we work with a organization called Peace Trees Vietnam that has been doing that since 1995. And they've cleared in that time some 55,000 ordinances. And of course, there's many more to be cleared and diffused. So, Mike was speaking of leakage at military bases. A couple years ago, there was a big article about what was happening in Hawaii at the joint base, Pearl Harbor Hickman base, where people had to leave their homes. People had to be given bottled water. Many of them had to seek medical care. And the military there just didn't inform the people. And when the people complained, they say, oh, there's not really a problem here. But they had a fuel spill of antifreeze that leaked into many of the wells. And a lot of these holding facilities are from World War II. And so they begin to leak after a while. And but a lot of the water in the wells and around the base were contaminated. And it was a big embarrassment for the Department of Defense and the military there in Oahu. You might have heard about Camp Lejeune. It's been on ads. You know, if you ever worked there or were on the base or around there, their water was contaminated with chemicals leaking into the aquifers and not properly storing them in their facilities that held the chemicals. And I'm going to talk a little more about this chemical that you were talking about, Mike, that's hard to pronounce, but I call PFAS.
Yeah, PFAS, yeah.
PFAS. But this is a chemical foam that they use for fighting fires, mostly fires if on jet fuel and high octane fuel. And so most military bases has this PFAS, and it's been a problem all around the world of leaking PFAS into the environment, into wells, into the soil. And it's an ongoing investigation. And what it does to the body, it disrupts the immune system, it interferes with hormones, it risks prostate, kidney, and testicle cancer, and messes with the reproductive system, according to the EPA. According to the EPA, 700 military installations in our country were found to, at 89% of them were found to have PFAS detected in or near aquifers that serve a source of drinking water. And many, many other wells around the world, literally around the world with overseas bases plus our bases here. And you already talked about the some of the local bases that are having problems, like the Yakima Training Center, Whidbey Island, Naval Base Kitsap, Fairchild Air Base, all are having problems of leaking PFAS that are causing problems and environmental destruction, not to mention human illness. But another way to look at the environmental discussion of the military is to look at the Superfunds. Two-thirds of the 29 Superfund sites, two-thirds of them are related to the military. And 48 of those are in Washington. So that's an indication of, you know, if you've got a military base in your state or a lot of them, you're going to have certainly a Superfund probably and certainly environmental problems. And of course, the number one super site is, like you mentioned, Mike, is Hanford Nuclear Reservations with its radioactive waste leaking out of the tanks and getting close to getting into the Columbia River. And we've been decades trying to clean that place up, and it'll be many more decades before that environmental disaster is really taken care of. Because, of course, you know, nuclear weapons is the ultimate environmental killer. We saw that from the two that were used in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Everything was destroyed. And in this country, there's what are called downwinders from the tests that happened in the 40s, late 40s, 50s, of doing nuclear tests that affected a lot of people with the ash from the nuclear explosions blowing to towns and places where they did these tests. So those are just a few of the examples of the military environmental damage that is happening in our country and around the world, and why it's so important us for not only to be aware of it, but to become active. And if you live near a base or in a state where there's a military base, you can be sure that there's problems, and those need to be looked into.
Well, our VFP and others organizations continuing research into this issue is critical. And I would suggest that we raise the issue of actually inspections upon military bases themselves and try to determine what sort of contamination there is present. You mentioned the environmental damage accrued from Agent Orange and others. That's also the environmental damage if you include people as part of the environment. That would include, of course, in Vietnam, the Vietnamese, and also the American soldiers who served there. More recently, of course, is Iraq and Afghanistan soldiers who were using depleted uranium shells. And that contaminate is now into the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly in Iraq, where you use depleted uranium shells. You're used to destroy Iraqi tanks, and that depleted uranium has now contaminated the desert. So it is, as you say, something that goes on. We're just about out of time for this sort of thing. Any final sort of
Do we have time to mention the books?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I mentioned three books. One's called The Green Zone, The Environmental Cost of Militarism. It's by Barry Sanders. Another one with over 50 authors, edited by Gar Smith, called The War and the Environment Reader. The War and Environment Reader by Gar Smith. And it just has articles on many different subjects related to war and the environment. And the last one is Poisoning the Pacific, U.S. Military Secret Dumping of Plutonium, Chemical Weapons, and Agent Orange. It's by John Mitchell, J-O-N Mitchell. Noam Chomsky calls an eloquent call to bring this tragedy to an end without delay. And maybe to end this, there's a quote from this book that I think is really astonishing, that reminds us why we need to do this work and how urgent it is. He says, "Here's the awful truth. Even if every person, every automobile, and every factory suddenly emitted zero emissions, the Earth would still be headed headfirst and at full speed toward total disaster for one major reason. The military produces enough greenhouse gases by itself to place the entire globe with all its inhabitants, large and small, in the most imminent danger of extinction."
Well, that's a grim way to end it, but that's a good way to end it. Thank you, Dan Gilman, Will Alexson, for your leadership in doing this thing. I appreciate it, particularly Will, as your leadership with the climate crisis team. So this is KODX 96.9, Veterans for Peace radio show, signing off. Thank you.